From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It seems like Flight 370 could be anywhere now, but it didn't come out of nowhere. It came out of Malaysia. In the 11-12 days since the flight's disappearance, Malaysia has felt a spotlight like never before in its history. What the world is learning is eye-opening. A country of affirmative action for the majority, of hardball politics and racial tension. This hour on Point, we're looking at Flight 370's country of origin, Malaysia. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you looking everywhere now for answers on this flight? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. High tension as the days go by and by and by. Two-thirds of the passengers in that plane, 239 in total on board, were Chinese. At a briefing, a press briefing yesterday in Kuala Lumpur, capital of Malaysia, relatives of some of the missing Chinese passengers tried to unfurl a banner, were physically dragged out of the room screaming. Just imagine the emotion. In that press conference from Kuala Lumpur earlier today, Acting Transport Minister Hashimuddin Hussein reacted to that disturbance by grieving relatives of the missing Chinese passengers, saying the Malaysian government is doing their best for the passengers' families.
I indicated in my statement earlier that we're sending another high-level team to travel to Beijing to explain what we're doing. And I hope and I appeal to everybody that though we understand their concerns, we are trying our very best. And it is heart-wrenching, even for me.
Try to understand. We're doing our very best, the Malaysian transport minister is saying there. And we're sending another high-level team, he said, to Beijing, where the focus on this is fierce. Stuart Grudgings joins us right now from the Malaysian capital, Kuala Lumpur. He's Malaysia bureau chief for Reuters News Service. Stuart, welcome to On Point. Do we have anything like a breakthrough on any front today?
Hi, Tom. I'm afraid it's really been 2 or 3 days now since we had any major move forward on the story, not since the Malaysian prime minister confirmed for the first time that the plane had flown back over the Malay Peninsula and then on into the Indian Ocean. The investigation, both in terms of the search and the investigation, the more sort of criminal side of the investigation, seems to have run into a dead end in the last few days. There's been drips and drabs of new information that have come out. But nothing really taking forward. And so we're in the stage now where people are really starting to think what would have been incredible just a few days ago, that this plane may in fact never be found and may be somewhere at the bottom of the Indian Ocean where it's going to be very hard to find.
Stuart, our line is breaking up as we speak. Perhaps we can reestablish it with you. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to let you go right there, but thank you for standing by in Kuala Lumpur. Also with us from Kuala Lumpur right now, Stuart Grudgings with Reuters. Thank you there. Ibrahim Sufian joins us. He's a Malaysian political analyst, director of the Merdeka Center, independent polling firm in Malaysia. Ibrahim Sufian, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom.
How is Malaysia handling the global scrutiny that has come with the disappearance of this plane?
Well, I think the country's authorities is growing in their ability in terms of being able to handle the kind of media spotlight. I think they are growing and learning on the job. We have an unprecedented situation, a crisis in which no one, for the most part in Malaysia, expected. And in the first 2 to 4 days, I think there's a bit of confusion with respect to how the Malaysian authorities are going to deal. There were a number of spokespersons, people representing different agencies taking on this particular issue. But I think as the week wore on, we noticed that the handling of the media's questions and so on became centered in the person of the acting transport minister, Hashimuddin, and he's been fielding the questions. I think the biggest challenge they have is, number one, the lack of concrete information in which to inform the families of the passenger as well as the rest of the world. And second, I think, is the stress and, pressure in dealing with the expectations of foreign governments, particularly the Chinese government, who have, more than 100 people on board that missing aircraft. That, I think, is the major problem or the situation that they're facing. But besides that, I mean, this issue has transfixed the whole nation. Everybody's looking at this, and people are not paying as much attention to the typical domestic politics that we are accustomed to.
And yet, politics are right in the middle of this still. I have a little tape here, Ibrahim, of the opposition leader in Malaysia, Anwar Ibrahim, slamming the Malaysian government's response to the missing flight. This was an interview with the Wall Street Journal yesterday.
It is a clear case of incompetence. We wanted to have a debate in Parliament. It was summarily rejected. Today, the acting Minister of Transport has invited only MPs from the ruling party, denying every single member of the opposition attending the special briefing on MH370. They seem to be hiding something. The whole report is not transparent. This is causing concern.
Opposition leader Anwar Ibrahim, very well known there, and we'll hear more about that, going after the Malaysian government yesterday, saying they seem to be hiding something. Ibrahim Sufyan, please stand by in Kuala Lumpur. With us right now as well from Melbourne, Australia, is Greg Barton, research professor at Monash University in Melbourne. He's director of the Center for Islam in the Modern World, steeped in Southeast Asian politics and in terrorism. Greg Barton, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Anwar Ibrahim speaking there, criticizing the Malaysian government. It was only one day before this flight went up, and these connections seem, or if they are connections, seem kind of wild. But this is the same opposition leader who the day before Flight 370 took off had an acquittal overturned on charges of sodomy that had been seen as very political in Malaysia. So he's now looking at 5-year term on charges of sodomy that will take him out of politics again. We've got a backdrop here, even a connection of the pilot to this opposition leader, Greg.
Yeah, there's lots of odd connections here, Tom. Sort of, I think lots of false leads with this case. Not all these dots can be joined. Malaysia's had the same government in power for 50 years, and a lot of Malaysians, particularly educated Malaysians like the pilot Captain Zahari, think it's about time there was a chance for a change. Anwar was supposed to be contesting an election in Selangor, the state where the capital is located, this weekend, and this court case takes him out of contention. He can't legally stand. So that's the context there. I don't think Zahari's support for Anwar has anything to do particularly, and the fact that it was dragged into this case partly explains Anwar's sense of outrage. But it also explains the political culture in which you've got a government that's never been out of power. It's not accustomed to people asking questions. This case has put it on the spotlight, and it's getting tough questions thrown at it, not least from the Malaysian, from the Chinese government. And its natural instinct is to duck and to try and avoid it, answering things full on when it actually would be better served by being as frank and direct as it could be.
Ibrahim Sufyan in Kuala Lumpur, these charges of sodomy go all the way back, the origins of them, to 1998. They've come out again and again when the opposition seems to be in position, Anwar Ibrahim in position maybe to really challenge this government that, as Greg says, has been in power for 50 years and more. We have seen reports that the pilot was actually sitting in the courtroom when this acquittal was overturned, when sodomy charges and prison time were put back on the plate of Anwar Ibrahim the day before the flight. Is that confirmed, Ibrahim?
Well, as far as I'm told, the presence of the pilot at the court on the day of the flight has not yet been confirmed. And this hasn't come out in any of the official briefings that we've heard from either the minister or the police. I've been trying to find out from people who were there, and most people that I spoke to couldn't recall seeing the individual. But having said that, I think the Malaysian political situation has been in this very heightened state for at least the last 5 to 6 years. And the reason is because ever since Mr. Anwar was acquitted on his first case in the year 2004, he has been in the forefront of running a campaign to take down the government through democratic means. I mean, he's been on a continuous election campaign since 2004 and was nearly able to do so in the recent election last year in May. And there is a lot of frustration, I suppose, amongst people who support the opposition And I think here in Malaysia, you have a sense of the irony in the sense that the popular vote of about 52% of the people actually voted for their opposition members of parliament, but the ruling party continued to run, to rule the country just with 60% of the seats in the parliament. So there's a great deal of frustration within Malaysia with respect to the political system. But again, the country is prosperous and most of the people are law-abiding, and there has been a kind of commitment to the democratic process. And that sort of rules out people taking radical measures to further their political interests. So while there is a kind of linkage there, because in the state of Selangor, where the pilot comes from, and where someone like Anwar Ibrahim operates, a majority of the population of nearly 2/3 actually voted for the opposition. So if you go to the urban areas, the middle class areas, majority, vast majority of the people actually voted for the opposition candidates.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're looking at Flight 370's country of origin this hour, Malaysia, the nation that has led the search for the missing airliner, the nation where it took off 11, nearly 12 days ago now. There's a lot of interesting politics and history here. Who knows? Maybe more. Everyone's baffled at what has happened with this plane. Of course, pilot and co-pilot Malaysian, in a YouTube video posted last year, the pilot, Zahari Ahmed Shah, offered tips on how to optimize a home air conditioner. Sounds pretty mild-mannered.
Hi, everyone. This is a YouTube video that I made as a community service after learning a lot from YouTube and forum and Wikipedia regarding the household air conditioning unit. We're basically talking about the inverter type, 1 horsepower, using the R410A gas.
YouTube from the pilot there on how to repair an air conditioner. Now there's talk in Malaysia about his politics. At a press briefing yesterday, the acting transport minister asked Malaysians to put political differences aside in response to the missing flight.
The search for MH370 is bigger than politics. I urge all Malaysians to put our differences aside and unite during this difficult time as we focus on finding the aircraft and the 239 people on board.
But the scrutiny on every side is intense now, and Malaysia getting a kind of looking over that it may never have had, not in this degree before. With us this hour from Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia, Ibrahim Sufian. He's a Malaysian political analyst, and it's great to have you here, Ibrahim. With us from Melbourne, Australia, Greg Barton. He's at Monash University in Melbourne, director of the Centre on Islam and the Modern World, looks at politics, terrorism. And with us right now as well from Singapore, Malaysia's southern neighbour, Bridget Welsh, professor of political science at Singapore Management University, an expert on Malaysian politics. Bridget, thank you very much for being with us today.
Nice to be here.
Could you give us just a little background as we come to know Malaysia? I spent a lot of time there back in the day, but most of the world is not familiar with this country, and some interesting things come to mind. I mean, first of all, just the fact that its political governing coalition has been in power ever since essentially its independence from Britain in 1957. How has the coalition managed to stay in power that long?
Well, I think, part of the reason it stayed in power is that it's been seen as a multi-ethnic coalition that's represented different communities. And so it's seen as basically dominating the middle of politics and actually connecting different communities. At the same time, for most of its tenure, it's actually been able to govern reasonably well in terms of managing and growing the economy. But over time, these areas of economic legitimacy and ethnic legitimacy, multi-ethnic community building them together, have actually been on the decline. And I think what we've seen in the last decade, particularly after 1999, that there's been a shift and a change in society, and the opposition has been gaining power by pushing for agenda of economic and political reform. And this is where you see now a society that has been described earlier as heavily polarized, politically, with the majority of the population wanting change and many of them wanting a change of government, and those that are actually staying in power that have actually benefited economically and through a lot of cronyism and capital and advantages of being in the system to stay on and want to maintain their position. So you see high levels of political polarization that's emerged out of a system that's not very much that is similar to a lot of the other countries where you've had one-party systems, where you have people who want to challenge and transform the system and open it up.
Bridget Welch, one of the things that strikes the eye from outside is the ethnic makeup of Malaysia. Majority ethnic Malay, native to that part of the world, then a substantial 20%+ Chinese population, which is relevant right now with the tension with China, I guess. Of course, a lot of folks from India as well, maybe 8% or something like that. But explain to us the policy, the so-called the Bumiputra, sons of the soil, this essentially large-scale affirmative action for the majority population of Malaysians that seems confusing on its face. What's that about, Bridget?
Well, politics in Malaysia is highly racialized and ethnicized. Political parties are organized along these lines, and political rights and representation has been organized along those lines. So we have about 57% of the population is the majority Malay community, and then 23% of the community is actually Chinese, 8% Indian, as you mentioned, and the rest are natives from an island of Borneo, which makes up East Malaysia.
Yep.
And in 1969, there was a racial riot. And in that racial riot, it brought attention to some of the inequalities between the different communities. And at that time, the majority of the people who were comparatively economically impoverished, the majority of them were Malay. While all the different communities had economically impoverished communities, the majority of those who were poor and disadvantaged were seen to be Malays. And the Chinese were seen to have the benefit and the majority of in the economy. And in 1971, after the racial riots, they introduced an affirmative action policy for the majority. And for two decades, one can argue that this had profound positive effects in terms of including creating education opportunities, transforming and aspects of the Malay community in terms of that more economic advantages, and incomes rose as a result of job creation and migration and other factors that happened with economic development that accompanied the affirmative action policy. But with all good policies as norm, that they reached a certain point of time where they become ineffective, and it has very unintended and negative consequences. And one of those negative consequences was to institutionalize racial politics in a very difficult way, where the ethnic minorities, particularly the Chinese and Indians and the ethnic communities in East Malaysia, did not receive the same advantages, and many of them suffered as a result of that. Of course, it also codified race and in the politics in a different way. And it also didn't benefit all the Malay communities evenly. Those that had access to the system benefited disproportionately more than those that didn't. And so you have now really very sharp divides within different communities. So there's a small cohort of very rich Malays, and there's actually quite a few that still are left being left behind because the policy is being used advantageously by those who have access in the system itself. And so you have an affirmative action policy that is actually really past its day, and it's one that needs to be rethought because it's based on race, not necessarily on needs. And I think that one of the problems is because racial politics is so codified and so institutionalized in Malaysia, where the dominant party who runs the coalition uses race to maintain its position, has in fact expanded ethnic allocations, particularly after the last election last May. The fact is it's very difficult to reform this. And this is one of the things that's holding Malaysia back, because there is no real structural reform that needs to reconfigure what type of development policies are more effective to make sure that all Malaysians across races have the same different opportunities that many people in the country want and need.
Ibrahim Sufian in Kuala Lumpur, do we see some of that ethnic tension in the tension right now between Malaysia and China? I mean, large Chinese population in Malaysia, historically and even now, very prominent in the business community, accounts for less than a third of the population, accounts for 70% maybe of the country's market capitalization. Historically, lots of, and even now, big agricultural products, rubber, palm oil, but also tin, petroleum. This privilege to Malays in Malay law, does it still fire ethnic tension there, Ibrahim?
Well, I mean, to put it in a very simple or direct way, the level of tension is not really very high, but there are certain areas which breed resentment. I think within the population itself, the level of tension is pretty low, and a lot of times the tensions are actually stoked by politicians. As Bridget was talking about, most of the political parties in Malaysia are organized around ethnic communities, and which means that they represent the interests of their ethnic community. And so, therefore, ethnic politics play a big role in the kind of rhetoric that we see in our press and also in the policies that the government comes out with. It's part and parcel of daily life. But there isn't the kind of visible tension that we see amongst people. Perhaps there are some latent or some stereotypes that people believe in underneath the surface, and we detect this in our surveys every now and then, but it has not really boiled over into any kind of open conflict as what we've seen 40 years ago. Now, if we take the mainland China, the People's Republic of China into the equation, and how Malaysians perceive China, for the most part, Malaysians, both Malays and particularly the Chinese, but Malays included, generally have a very positive view towards China, largely because they do not really see China as a threat, but rather as an opportunity, partly because China is Malaysia's largest trading partner right now, and is seen as a way to gain market access and to expand the economy. So from that standpoint, China's not really seen as a threat. And even if we look into the history of this country, when Malay sultanates or Malay kingdoms were established here hundreds of years ago, they have all generally established positive trading and protective relationship with China from against other threats. So there has always been a kind of relationship with China that's been benign for the most part. And so there isn't that kind of feeling of threat or danger coming in from China. But I think in recent times, there has been a bit of a concern, partly because Malaysia feels that it's losing its competitiveness, particularly in the area of manufacturing. A lot of larger companies have moved their factories over to China to take advantage of cheaper labor costs and larger numbers of skilled laborers and move it over there. And I think this is where I think the economic reform and the structural reforms that we just talked about is supposed to come in and fix this problem. Because I think the biggest area or issue of contention amongst Malaysians and especially policymakers is how to move the country out of this middle-income trap, because there is a feeling of stagnation and a feeling that the country is not developing, not growing fast enough to keep up with its neighbors and the others that used to be in the same league as it was, such as Korea and Taiwan.
Ibrahim Sufi on standby. Bridget Welsh, Greg Barton. Let me bring our listeners in. Marcia in Providence, Rhode Island. Marcia, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'm an active member of Amnesty International here in Providence, which doesn't have much to do with it. But I was really, when I saw in the newspaper the other day that Anwar Ibrahim had been charged yet again with sodomy, my thought was, oh no, not again. He had been previously charged. It was a very doubtful charge and a very sensitive charge to bring against a man in a Muslim-majority country.
And leading opposition politician.
That's correct. He is the leading opposition politician. I have been to Malaysia, but briefly. And he was he was cleared of that charge. And then suddenly, when another election is due, he's charged again with sodomy. It's a very sensitive charge, as I say, in a Muslim country. And there was no evidence ever that he was a sodomist. And it may have nothing to do with the captain in this case, but it's part of the background here.
It has a lot to do with Malaysian politics. There's no question about that. It has for a long time. Marcia, I appreciate your call. Greg Barton, let me come to you here. I mean, the captain was a supporter, is a supporter of the opposition party in Malaysia. There's been an attempt to politicize this, and at the same time, people trying to tamp it down. Can you see the possibility of a connection here? There were reports that in the recent election, the Malaysian government, of course, Malaysian Airlines is government owned. They were using those airliners to fly in voters from all over the place. Reports that was illicit voting going on with that. Those denied by the government. They're saying we're just getting out the vote. The pilot would have witnessed that. I mean, The word, you know, we talk about people running amok. The word amok is a Malay word. You're an expert in terrorism. Do you look at this and say, well, could the pilot have seen a political injustice and just gone amok up there?
Well, it's a good question, Tom. You know, on the face of it, it seems like a fair point to be putting, but I think anyone who's familiar with Malaysia knows that it just doesn't really make sense in this case. The fact that Anwar Ibrahim was set to contest the Selangor election, where those infamous race riots occurred in 69 and sort of an area that overlaps the national capital, is significant. And that's the whole background of the court case to knock him out of political contention. But his supporters, particularly people like Captain Zahari, are typically, we would say, educated liberals, and they tend to be nothing but urbane. They're certainly not prone to violence. So just no sense of it being likely that that's a factor on this. But it is a factor, as we've been discussing, on the political culture in Malaysia, a government that's used to not being asked too many tough questions, that really directly or indirectly controls all of the conventional media. And also, you know, as Bridget was explaining so well, has been behind a very successful affirmative action policy, but one which has gone sour, as these things do after a long while, and has unfortunately eroded a culture of meritocracy such that in many key institutions, including institutions like the National Defence Forces, the Air Force, there isn't the level of professionalism there might be if there was a more competitive meritocracy. And that's normally of no consequence, but when you've got Malaysian defence personnel failing to notice radar signals of an aircraft not being where it should be, it becomes a practical point, and it's a point of embarrassment.
I mean, Professor, I understand you're and everybody's resistance to the idea of a connection here, and fair enough, and we do not know. On the other hand, once it's put in a criminal context, a kind of criminal investigation of a deliberate takeover of the plane, then you have to look for motivation. And if not there, where at this point, Greg Barton?
Well, there's two big areas we might look, and of course, unfortunately, Tom, we're just stuck with speculation. Ordinarily, with an aircraft incident like this, we wouldn't be talking about terrorism. It's most unlikely. In this case, the sequence of how this aircraft disappeared and then did some very strange things, and then we now learn flew on for another 7 hours. That sequence speaks to somebody sabotaging or commandeering the aircraft in some way. It's not impossible, of course, that a tragic fire in the cockpit or cargo bay explains all of this, but terrorism becomes much more likely. Now, there are two areas of motivation. This was also a China Southern flight. It was flying to Beijing just when the Chinese Parliament was sitting for its annual sitting, and two-thirds of the passengers were Chinese nationals. So China being a target's a possibility, but the only groups that we know about that might, you know, possibly want to conduct an act of terrorism of this scale are Uyghur separatists, but they don't have the capacity. If we think about capacity, the groups that we think of are linked to Al-Qaeda, groups like Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP, the group behind the attempted underpants or underwear bomber.
Professor Barton, hold the thought right there if you'd be good enough. We have to take a short break. Bridget Welsh in Singapore, Ibrahim Sufyan in Kuala Lumpur. We're looking at the country of origin of Flight 370 Malaysia. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're looking this hour at Flight 370's country of origin, Malaysia, the nation that has led the search for the missing airliner. Greg Barton is with us from Melbourne, Australia, and Monash University there in Melbourne. Bridget Walsh from Singapore Management University in Singapore. Ibrahim Sufyan, Malaysian political analyst, joins us from Kuala Lumpur, where Flight 370 took off, nearly 12 days ago now. The Prime Minister of Malaysia here, Najib Razak, addressing concerns on Saturday about the transparency of his country's investigation into the flight.
We understand the desperate need for information. On behalf of the families and those watching around the world, but we have a responsibility to the investigation and the families to only release information that has been corroborated. And our primary motivation has always been to find the plane.
Of course, there's been a confusing and contradictory flow of information from the Malaysian government, some of it that suggests incompetence, other just obfuscation, and the opposition there has gone after that. Here again, the opposition leader in Malaysia, Anwar Ibrahim, criticizing the prime minister for not answering questions from the media.
This is the prime minister, and refusing to entertain questions from international media because they are used to a compliant media controlled by them. But they wouldn't want to deal with the BBC and the international media. And this reflects very badly on our handling and capacity to manage a crisis.
Our listeners are listening very closely, and there's a sympathy here for Malaysia. Here's one listener writing to us online. For those who are quick to criticize Malaysia for not having safeguards in place to prevent whatever took place from occurring, let's remember that the U.S. was totally blindsided by the events of 9/11. Fair enough. And still, Chris in Dover, Delaware. Chris, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Heartfelt sorrow for the families of the parties that were on that airliner. I think, you know, we do have some inaction on the government to act quickly to investigate it. And then I believe there needs to be a world page on aviation and, you know, everything from the ground employees to, you know, the employees that are actually, you know, control towers, the pilots. I think there's a huge lack of that throughout the world. My family and I travel. We have not been to Malaysia, but, you know, they didn't act quickly. They have not been forthcoming. And, you know, I don't know what our country or the other countries can do to get them to get on the same page. We're very late in the game on this.
Yeah, Chris, let us pick it up right there if we could. Thank you for your call. I mean, a lot of disconcerting revelations here about how things work internationally, but the delay in Malaysia, quite significant, Greg Barton, I would think, in helping get on top of this. The Prime Minister said we want to be transparent, but they were letting everybody search the Gulf of Thailand while it seems apparent that they might well have understood the plane was nowhere near there.
Yeah, very good point, Tom. I mean, to be fair to the Malaysian government, the Malaysian people, they're facing a challenge that's pretty much unprecedented. Any country would struggle. But when the spotlight's on them, there's a lot of things that are a harsh truth. They were very slow getting off to this whole response, and it's lost precious time. It's just made a difficult problem that much more difficult.
Every day matters here. Here's a from Twitter. Sal writes about the news that we found there were deletions found on the captain's flight simulator. Deleted data, Sal writes to us, can be recovered. Will this break the mystery? This goes back to early last month. He was a flight enthusiast. He had a flight simulator in his home. We've heard this is not uncommon for pilots practicing landings at different locations, but everything was deleted back before February 3rd. If that can be reconstituted, does that look like a promising area to you, Greg Barton, for potential clues?
Look, it's something investigators have to look at, of course, but I really don't. I mean, I'm just talking about my own instinctual response from the facts that we do know. I can't imagine it's going to have particular bearing on this case. Anyone who plays computer games or does that sort of recreational work is going to occasionally reset things and delete things. Now, they should certainly get back whatever data they can, but Captain Zahari, it just doesn't seem likely that he's been directly involved in what's happened, except he's obviously been caught up in the drama in the cockpit.
Michael in Lexington, Kentucky. Michael, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. 2 points. One is that someone at Boeing knew or should have known within, say, half an hour of the time that communication was lost that those engines were still running. And how that information did not get either to Malaysia or how Malaysia didn't put it out for a week is unbelievable. The second point is that I think that airplane was stolen. I think it's being readied for a 9/11 style attack somewhere. Why else would anyone steal an airliner? You can't resell it. You can't part it out.
Why not just as likely and tragically, Michael, at the bottom of the Indian Ocean, burned?
Well, because it flew for many hours after it lost contact. So my assumption is that someone was in command of it, and why would they crash it 5 hours later rather than land it at some prearranged lightly used landing strip and stick it in the hangar and then get it ready to fly it into a building somewhere.
Yeah, Michael, I appreciate your call from Lexington, Kentucky. Ibrahim Sufyan, what do people talk about this scenario in Malaysia? It certainly has imaginations around the world. You look at that arc of potential destinations the plane could have reached, you know, all the way over the Himalayas and into Kazakhstan, Afghanistan. I mean, some people even say Somalia. In Malaysia, is there speculation that the plane may have been stolen and landed somewhere, Ibrahim?
Yes, of course, Tom. I mean, it's one of the competing theories out there about the fate of the aircraft. I mean, there's various different versions, and the local online and local media has been, you know, having a field day entertaining every single theory that has come about, including some stories from Russian websites saying that the aircraft has been stolen and taken to the American base at Diego Garcia, which is something that's being pushed also by the mainstream newspaper. So there's a large number of theories out there, ranging from the tragic to the one others that are more bizarre, and they're all competing. And the fact is, nobody really knows what's going on, and I think the authorities also do not know what's going on. I think if we look back in terms of what's going on, particularly assuming that some kind of foul play is in question, assuming that there was no mechanical error or problem and that there's something going on, because we do know that the plane deviated from its original flight plan, I mean, the answers could be amongst the many passengers on board. I think the reason right now that the focus is placed mainly on the pilot is because that's within the realm of the control of the Malaysian authorities. Malaysian authorities only have access to information or background information about passengers that are Malaysian citizens. They probably wouldn't have access to data for the other passengers. I mean, the two-thirds of the other passengers that are foreign nationals, many of whom are the Chinese, are from China.
But of course, there was a sophisticated handling of this, apparently. Somebody reprogrammed the computer to turn the plane. Many are saying that would take some expertise. When you think about this pilot, co-pilot Ibrahim, what are your thoughts? Do you see the possibility of a run amok scenario here where, for political reasons or any other, despite all appearances of being a very level-headed guy, we might have had a pilot with suddenly some different agenda? Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, I mean, I can see where that's coming from because, you know, it's quite interesting to paint the picture that he's a man who's run amok or, you know, something snapped within him psychologically. But we're not really sure. I mean, that's among one of the many competing theories. I mean, the feeling, at least in town, at least in Malaysia right now, is that, of course, people are divided within the political sides here. I mean, people who are inclined with the opposition, you know, think that it's not very unlikely, and some people who are hardcore supporters of the government think that it's somewhat probable. But that's basically the kind of shadows or shades of information that we have right now. We don't have information about most of the other passengers. We don't know who they are. And that's what we are being given right now. So I think that's the most prevalent theory, although I find it personally a bit hard to believe because if you wanted to, you know, if pilot suicide or something negative is coming from the pilot, you might have done something much sooner rather than take the plane out for 7 hours.
Yes, of course, it wasn't that long after takeoff that things began to happen here. Bridget Walsh, what about Malaysia's relationship with China as this unfolds? It was just last fall that the new Chinese president, Xi Jinping, signed this treaty with Malaysia, comprehensive strategic partnership, more military cooperation, tripling bilateral trade to $160 billion in the next few years. China's Malaysia's largest trading partner. But the tension here has been palpable and deep. A lot of criticism from China of how Malaysia's handled this. How do you think this may affect the relation of the great power in the region, China and Malaysia, Bridget?
I think they're going to be quite profound implications. I think, you know, this year was China's, this is Malaysia year, and the majority of people who were coming were Chinese tourists. I think the implication will be that this will really dry up a huge part of the economic resources and connections and connectivity between China and Malaysia, because it's going to take a long time for this to actually be addressed in a substantial way. I also think that the communication and the handling of the Chinese families in particular, I think, could clearly have been done better. I think that there was not an effective Chinese spokespeople, and some of the timing of the briefings and the sharing of information really showed a lack of cultural understanding and connectivity that I think has really created that perspective in China that is very anti-Malaysia. And I think many people in China are asking questions, including the Chinese media, which has been highly critical of Malaysia. And in response, we've seen Malaysia turning more to the United States and acknowledging the U.S. presence and others. And so you're going to have a shifting great power dynamic as well in part of this dynamic that is taking place. So I see real significant shifts in the bilateral relationships, both with China and with the United States. I also see a situation where China more globally is now going to have a rethink about its relations and its security dynamics in the region. This incident will give the PLA and the Chinese Army a green light for them to make more demands for issues of security and control in the region, which has already been happening over the last 2 years, as they have a more hardline and expansion in areas of territory. So I think there will be a quite significant tectonic security ramifications on multiple global, regional, and bilateral levels.
Greg Barton, what about on that front? Do you see China bulking up forces in the region in the wake of this to give them more capacity to respond? And what about the stolen aircraft scenario that our listener raises? Ibrahim Sufyan says in Malaysia people talk about it. Of course, everybody speculates. If something like that is out there, it could be in China, could be anywhere. Do you see China bulking up special forces to be able to go after a scenario like that now or in the future?
Well, Tom, I think Bridget made some very cogent points, and your point too about this being a ground for China building their own capacity. It's a pity this search starting in the South China Sea east of the Malaysian Peninsula, a contested area, saw such good cooperation, and the fact that it's now under a shadow because it looks like Malaysia was slow to acknowledge that they should have been looking westwards is very galling to Malaysia to China and undermines a lot of that good work. The stolen aircraft thesis, I think if this proves to be terrorism, we may never know, of course, but if it proves to be terrorism and the aircraft was hijacked, I think it's very likely it was hijacked for a 9/11 style attack. But I think that only makes sense if the aircraft is used directly. I think it's just stretching credulity to imagine you can take an aircraft like this and hide it. You could put it down this a fairly modest strip, it's true, but you wouldn't have a hangar big enough to hide a 777, and by now it would have been found out. I think what is possible is the intention was to take the aircraft and use it as a 9/11-style weapon in itself, perhaps downtown KL, and somehow perhaps the pilots were able to thwart that, and one or both of them, and that side of the attack was unsuccessful.
Who would have an interest, Professor Barton, in going after downtown Kuala Lumpur? Now, I know they've got one of the tallest twin towers there in the world. It was the tallest in the world for a while, but, I mean, that's it. Who would have an interest in doing a 9/11-style attack in Kuala Lumpur?
Well, the elephant in the room is Al-Qaeda. It has the capacity, at least its affiliates.
But why attack Malaysia? It's an Islamic country.
Well, very good question, Tom. Malaysia's had a long history of association with Al-Qaeda, not of its own fault, but two aspects here. One, it's had an open borders policy with the Middle East. It's been successful in encouraging a lot of trade and visitors, but it's also meant a lot of Al-Qaeda people have moved through KL. The 9/11 attacks were partly planned in KL. The regional terrorists involved in Jamaat Islamiyah and other networks, many of them come from Malaysia. Many of the attacks were planned in Malaysia. The politics of Malaysia we've been discussing involve focus on communal politics, but also on the instrumental use of religion. And that contributed to a growing tone of fundamentalism that doesn't dissuade most Malaysians and most Muslims in Malaysia, but it means that some, particularly amongst the youth, have been vulnerable. We've always thought that Al-Qaeda wouldn't attack Malaysia because it's against its interests, but it's entirely possible that some element of the broad Al-Qaeda franchise network decided that it would be a spectacular achievement if they could do something. And so the logic of terrorism is not always transparent to us. But Malaysia, which seems so safe from an Al-Qaeda-style attack, may in fact be a victim on this occasion.
If you had to your best guess right now, Greg Barton, is that plane in the sea or on the ground?
My best guess is it turned south on that southern arc into the southern Indian Ocean, where it's unfortunately it's 7,000 meters deep, and I think it's all too likely it'll never be found. I think that it may have been a terrorist attempt, or it may have been a terrorist attack, but it was only partially successful, and that's why we're not hearing more from a group planning credit.
Greg Barton at Monash University in Melbourne, Australia. Thank you very much for joining us today, Professor Barton.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Bridget Welsh at Singapore Management University in Singapore. Professor Welsh, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, and let's hope that we do find the plane and the families.
Yes, indeed. Yes, Ibrahim Sufyan in Kuala Lumpur, thanks to you as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.